Welcome, friends. James Corbett here, CorbettReport.com. Today is the 3rd of August, 2014, and today we are joined on the line by Dr. Gary Coles, a retired physician who has been living and working in Duluth for some time. We'll get more into that and his former practice in Duluth, Minnesota. He is also a contributor to the Duluth Reader at duluthreader.com, and we're going to be talking specifically about one article that was just released last week that will be linked in the show notes for this episode at CorbettReport.com, The Hiroshima Myth and the Glorification of American Militarism. Dr. Coles, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Well, I'm honored to be on your program, David. I've admired your work for a long time.
Well, that is very flattering to hear. And it's your first time on the program, and it's customary for us to just find out a little bit about our guests the first time we talk to them. Tell us a little bit about your own background and how you came to be a contributor for the Duluth Reader.
Yeah, I've been kind of an anti-war activist, or anti-fascist, I guess is a more concise term for it, for all my life. I was raised gently in rural Minnesota, so I didn't have any childhood traumas or anything, wasn't beaten as a child. I managed to evade the Vietnam War inadvertently because I was in medical school at the time of the Vietnam War and was guaranteed an exemption if I practiced in rural medicine in rural Minnesota, which I had intended to do all my life anyway. So I got out. I wasn't subject to combat trauma. Practiced in rural Minnesota for 30 years and then moved to Duluth, where I set up an independent practice of what I called holistic mental health care. It evolved into actually taking people off of their psychiatric medications for the entire decade until I retired about 5 years ago. And I worked at a mental institution for a couple years in the 90s as well. So I was attuned to the reality of psychological trauma and causing post-traumatic stress disorder, which is really at the basis of most so-called mental illnesses of unknown cause, which are actually psychological, spiritual trauma that alters brain function, actually brain anatomy as well. And the psychiatric medications, which are known neurotoxins, which can cause memory loss and disability and atrophy. And so it's probably one of the major causes of dementia, as opposed to Alzheimer's of unknown cause. We have drug-induced dementia because of the widespread use of psychiatric drugs that people take for years and years and decades sometimes. So I did a lot of counseling during my practice, saw a lot of veterans, combat veterans, and victims of child abuse and rape trauma, all the different forms of emotional abuse, etc., that can make people, quote, crazy, unquote, or act that way and get a label and get a drug. So since my retirement, I have done a lot of writing. I took up editorializing as an unpaid career and contribute weekly to our alternative news weekly here in Duluth, Minnesota, called the Duluth Reader. And that's how we hooked up. I guess you found my article on Hiroshima on the Rockwell site, and here we are.
Yes, that's exactly right. So I did find your post via louisrockwell.com, and it is, I think, a very important post. And of course, this is coming just a few days in advance of the 69th anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima on August 6th, and then the 69th anniversary of Nagasaki will be on August 9th. So obviously, an extremely important point in world history, and one of which much has been written. But of course, as you point out in your article, a lot of what has been written and handed down through the generations by a lot of people with military veterans in their family has centered around some of the fundamental myths that were set in the early stages of the sort of propagandistic myth about those bombings and their necessity. Why don't we talk a little bit about those myths that still surround this very important point in history, and really, what was the motivation for you to write this article?
Yeah, well, my whole medical career and all writing career has been in trying to demystify or demythologize mistaken impressions, and oftentimes there have been origins have been corporate money-making tactics to get people to buy a product or be convinced of American exceptionalism, et cetera, et cetera. So I sort of fancy myself as being capable of reading between the lines trying to determine what the truth of the matter is. One of the famous quotes near the title of a book is, "The first casualty of war is truth." And so we start getting the propaganda in the preparation for war. We get propaganda from Big Pharma in getting us physicians to prescribe drugs and getting patients to demand to have them prescribed for them, et cetera, et cetera. It just surrounds us totally that there are myths, propaganda, that are designed to convince us to do something that isn't in our best interest. So I kind of like looking at conventional wisdom and trying to decide what is the truth. That's why, you know, I'm a 9/11 truth seeker, and I've written quite a bit about the 9/11 thing, and I know that you have too. I really admire your recent quick 5 minutes on the fallacies of the White House 9/11 conspiracy theory. So Hiroshima was a big one. You know, I have half a dozen books, including one by Garl Perowitz. It's just so obvious that if one looks at the reality of that historical event and the development of the bomb, et cetera, that there have been all sorts of cover-ups and state secrets about this that we're trying to, and I've decided now that these are the people who are trying to cover up the reality of what happened there, that this was a terror attack and indiscriminate and an international war crime, was the military people and political people to try to cover up the fact that they were involved in war crimes. They're war criminals, and so they'll do anything they have to do to cover up that fact, and therefore they come up with the myth that, well, we had to bomb Hiroshima to prevent, you know, 250,000 American GIs from losing their lives by invading Japan later, and all the Japanese civilians that would be killed by the invasion. And so that whole myth that we had to bomb Hiroshima is so easily demythologized and the truth uncovered that it just begs exposure. So I also on the Rockwell site a couple years ago, I came across a piece that was written that showed that the U.S. government, when they realized how horrific both atomic bombings were, they decided they had to create the myth that it was necessary. And so they got the Secretary of War, Henry Stimson, to write a long article with McGeorge Bundy, and this was a couple years later, to establish by falsehood the myth that we had to bomb Hiroshima. So that needs to be exposed because it was a lie. It was a total lie, and the military veterans, especially World War II veterans, just refused to believe that we didn't have to use the bombs. And so that had to be exposed. I'm just kind of a truth teller and a truth seeker, and you as well. There's so many falsehoods out there that have created our national strategy, our military strategy, our colonialization strategy, the economy, et cetera. And we've been led down the primrose path to the eve of destruction here by believing the myths that really should not have existed in the first place.
Right. Well, I think as you gesture towards there, one of the general points is that war criminal is really just a synonym for loser, and hero is a synonym for victor. And if that's the general rule, then a specific instance of that would be something like Hiroshima. So let's look at this the mythology that has built up about why this was necessary. A lot of people have convinced themselves or have been convinced that this was absolutely something that was necessary to bring World War II to a close. And I imagine when you were growing up and learning about World War II in school, that this is the history as it was presented to you. Tell us a little bit about that narrative of why many Americans still believe that this was such a necessary strike.
Well, it's the big lie strategy, and if you tell a lie often enough and loud enough, people will come to believe it. As Joseph Goebbels, Minister of Propaganda and Public Enlightenment for Hitler, devised that, or maybe he just was repeating it. But if you tell a lie often enough, people will tend to believe it. That happened with 9/11. It's happened with, you know, any number of conspiracies that have occurred, and include the atomic bombing. So we just, and the media, which is a big corporation, corporations do stuff for their best interests, whatever interests them or profits them, they'll do it. And so the big media enterprises did not do the good investigative journalism, or were prevented from doing the good investigative journalism. There were journalists there that knew the truth, but they were suppressed and censored. So press censorship then eliminates the truth teller, and then we get the lies. And the Hiroshima myth that we had to use the bomb to end the war was one of them. And actually, the Manhattan Project cost $2 billion in 1940s money, and it was a huge investment. And they were actually, you know, most of the research physicists and chemists that worked on the Manhattan Project were refugees from Hitler, and they thought that they were building a bomb to make it before Hitler could make it. And so the original intent of the Manhattan Project scientists was that it was going to be used, if at all, against Germany. And when Germany surrendered before they had a chance to develop it, well, there they had this big investment in this bomb. And how are they going to explain wasting $2 billion on a huge project and then not use it? So they had this use it or lose it mentality, and his investment to protect, and so they had to find another victim, and therefore that was Japan, because that war hadn't ended yet. There was a revenge, obviously a revenge thing. You know, they had the surprise attack against Pearl Harbor in 1941. That was before we'd even been thinking of having the Manhattan Project. And 2,500 soldiers, you know, soldiers were killed, no civilians, no civilian targets at Pearl Harbor, just military targets. And so we had this desire to get back at Japan because of that, and we certainly did. So we weren't going to stop until we had totally annihilated or gotten them to surrender. So there was that revenge factor. And then there was that scientific curiosity. You know, on June 16, 45 was when the Trinity project used the first plutonium bomb, Trinity, on July 16th. And so they had they knew a little bit of what would happen in the desert reality with a plutonium bomb, but we didn't know what would happen against the city. And the Hiroshima bomb was uranium, because that one hadn't even been exploded yet. That was totally experimental. So there was this scientific curiosity, what would happen against a city with using a uranium bomb? What would happen against a city using a plutonium bomb? So there was that curiosity. We didn't know for sure, you know, we didn't even know it was going to work. So that was kind of in there too. Leslie Groves, the general that was the project manager, it was a hard-driving Napoleon-type guy, and he definitely did not want to see the bomb just lay there after all this effort. We needed to use it or lose it, so to speak. And, of course, the people the soldiers, the airmen, who were instrumental in dropping the bomb, they were just obeying orders, you know, and almost all of them justified the use of the bomb. They didn't want to blame themselves. They were just obeying orders, and so that everything they did in their lives afterwards was justifying why they did it. But it boiled down to they were just obeying orders. What could they do? You know, that nobody, people of conscience are not welcome in the military because you may have to obey orders that later on you're going to regret and feel guilty about. So people naturally do whatever they can to not feel guilt or shame or humiliation. So there's, and if you want me to, we could go into the psychological realities, but that could be another discussion, I suppose. And then the other thing, the Russians were coming. at the end of the European War, V-Day, Russia declared war against Japan. And so they said, we're going to attack Japan 2 months after that, I guess 60 days or 90 days afterwards, which turned out to be August 8th, was the time they were going to march and get their share of the spoils. But they had lost a humiliating war in 1905 against Japan. So Russia had been humiliated. It was a sea battle. And they, a lot of their military ships were destroyed by a superior Japanese upstart navy. And so that was eating at them, I'm sure. They wanted revenge against Japan for their humiliating loss in 1905. Nations and militaries especially have a long memory for humiliation, and they want revenge. The South, even the South still keep saying the South will rise again. They still are hurting for losing the Civil War in America in the mid-1800s. Anyway, we knew that Russia was going to be our major, a major opponent, an international opponent after the war, because they were part of the victorious side in World War II. And so our atomic bomb was sort of used as one of the first messages in the Cold War. We got these bombs, you don't, they're powerful. And it was sort of a statement that you better back off and not try to threaten our supremacy in the world. And, of course, we exploded those bombs before Russia had a chance to share in the spoils of war against Japan. So those are just a half a dozen reasons why the bomb was used not to end the war, but for other purposes.
That's absolutely right. It's a very, detailed itemization when you go into it in the article, and I suggest people do, because, again, it shows that there is every motivation on the behalf of the United States to use these bombs. Among all of those motivations, the one that is conspicuously lacking is the one that has traditionally been given for the necessity of why these bombs just had to be dropped on Japan, which was, of course, to prevent the protracted, drawn-out battle against mainland Japan or Okinawa that was going to have to take place. And would undoubtedly lead to the loss of so many lives, which, of course, was really not the case, as we now know from so many different declassified records, and one that you point to in the article itself, where you write, on July 13th, 1945, Foreign Minister Togo of Japan said, unconditional surrender, giving up all sovereignty, which included deposing the Emperor Hirohito, is the only obstacle to peace. The implication being that Japan was looking for ways to surrender. Let's explore that concept a little bit.
Yeah, there's evidence with the declassified information now, both in Russia and Japan and the United States and Britain, that Japan was looking for ways of surrender months before the bombs. So, but I don't know all the details, but I can't articulate them, but Alan Dulles, the future head of the CIA, was involved in hearing some of these peace feelers from Japan. I don't think he did anything about it. There was just this momentum in ending the war with those bombs that kept us from really negotiating with Japan. We made harsh conditions, and the unconditional surrender means that the nation gives up all sovereignty, and they even insisted that Hirohito be possibly tried as a war criminal, and that's what that statement you just read meant. He was the god. He was the deity of Japanese of Japan, and his line of the emperors before him was that he was a god. And so when the United States demanded that he lose his godhead status, that's the thing they couldn't tolerate. They would have surrendered in a minute if the U.S. had just said, okay, we'll let you have Hirohito as a figurehead leader. But they even demanded that that not be the case. So Japan might have surrendered before Okinawa. You know, we might have had tens of thousands of Marines still alive without Okinawa, if we had said, okay, we'll let you surrender, we won't drop the bomb on you, we'll let you surrender, and that would have been it. But no, we had this momentum, we wanted to squash this thing with a bang, probably. I imagine that would be the thing that General Gorge, Leslie Groves, he just wanted to make sure that that weapon was used. And Truman, who didn't know very much about it, was in his back pocket. So the Japanese were looking for ways to an honorable surrender, even though they were, you know, the military leadership in Japan had done the rape of Nanking and all sorts of atrocities and done medical experimentation as bad as the Nazis. And they'd done some horrible things, obviously. And so they were bad actors, but the people weren't, you know, and most of the people in Hiroshima and Nagasaki were civilians, overwhelmingly. Hiroshima was not a military target. They didn't have any fuel left, they didn't have any steel left, they didn't have anything to make any more weapons. And so the Mitsubishi plant, which was in Nagasaki, was essentially worthless. And there were no military targets in Hiroshima, virtually 100% civilians. There were some Japanese conscripts, but they didn't have any guns. They were just young conscripts that were training with wooden rifles or something. There were 12 Allied pilots that were in the Hiroshima prison at the time of the bombing, and the U.S. military command knew of their existence, and yet they still went ahead with the bomb and incinerated those 12 Allied pilots. So there's a lot of information that was suppressed. MacArthur, one of the first things General MacArthur did in Japan when he took over as viceroy of Japan, so to speak, was confiscate all the film and still photos of the atrocities, the human suffering. All he allowed out were some photos that showed the devastation, but none of the human suffering. That was all either confiscated or destroyed. So MacArthur knew that public opinion was important to maintain the mythology that this was necessary and suppress the information. And he restricted journalists. He didn't let any journalists that were going to tell the truth in there or be able to report it. So it was a propaganda job from day one, and therefore we Americans have thought it was a glorious end of the war when it was actually an international war crime.
It's sad, but true. Yes, exactly. Very predictable. And they knew even back then that manipulating the message was even in some ways more important than the acts themselves. And on that note, I mean, one of the things that many people have pointed out is that on the scale of war crimes, arguably an even bigger war crime, and certainly in terms of the devastation that it ultimately caused, was the firebombing campaign that was used not only in Germany but also in Japan, which in Japan had a pretty devastating effect, having destroyed 3.1 million homes. It left 15 million people homeless, killed about a million of them. Of course, we're talking almost exclusively civilians here, sure, talking about wide swaths of Tokyo and many, many other cities in Japan as well. In fact, there was a very effective scene in the early Errol Morris's 2003 documentary, The Fog of War, with Robert McNamara, where they displayed on the screen some of the devastation, the percentage of entire cities that were firebombed out of existence, and overlaid that with comparable cities in the United States. So, you know, Osaka would be like a Detroit or something like that. And it was a very effective scene because it showed just the scale of the devastation that was caused in the firebombing campaign, and that it itself, of course, had greatly weakened Japan's resolve and its ability to fight against the United States. And as many point out, of course, not only is that a despicable war crime in itself, again targeting mostly civilians, but also it in another way, I think, gives the lie to the necessity of the atomic bombings, because, again, so much devastation, in fact, much more devastation than that those two bombs themselves were committed during the course of that campaign. So why would yet another act of devastation be that tipping point? I mean, I think, again, there's certainly a case to be made that Japan had already was already quite familiar with the destructive capacities of the United States Air Force.
Yeah, and you know, that's interesting too. Another sign that the bombs didn't have to be dropped was the firebombing that had occurred in the spring of 45 that destroyed 60 plus major cities in Japan already with a firebombing, napalm. They carefully selected three or four cities to not firebomb. And they were just—you knew—they were planning to use them, one or two of them, as targets for the atomic bombing. So they carefully selected Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and Nagasaki. I have written about this before, but I can't remember their names. One of the original imperial city was saved from firebombing as potential targets for the atomic bomb. So again, that scientific curiosity. Let's not bomb a city that's already been firebombed. Let's have an intact city. So Hiroshima and Nagasaki were both privileged to not have been firebombed, and so they were intact cities. So part of this experiment, this scientific curiosity, what would happen to an intact city? So there was a very careful selection committee. There was a selection committee that analyzed before the firebombing which cities to save for the nuclear weapons. So,
yeah.
So Hiroshima kind of wondered, well, I wonder why we're not being firebombed like everybody else. And I suppose the citizens of Nagasaki were kind of wondering too. They were probably thought that they were kind of fortunate that the United States had not firebombed them yet.
I think there's a lesson in there on multiple levels. When you see the devastation all around, but you are miraculously spared, you might wonder what else is in store for you. But that's an entire area that of course, just as we said before, in the winners get to be called heroes no matter what types of atrocities they commit, while the losers are the ones whose crimes are highlighted. And of course, this is not to downplay or to take away from the very disturbing and despicable crimes that the Japanese Imperial Army committed in their various conquests throughout East Asia and during World War II and the despicable things that they did. But of course, that does not justify in any way the type of atrocity that was committed in Hiroshima or Nagasaki. The interesting part about this from my perspective is that I'm a relatively young man in my mid-30s, and I think I'm of a generation for whom the idea that the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombings were not necessary is, if not at least the mainstream or mainline accepted version of events, it is certainly one that I think we've probably all been exposed to. I think everyone has heard this argument at some point before. And because of that, because I think this argument against the necessity of Hiroshima and Nagasaki has filtered down to the general public, I think there's now at this point actually a type of reactionary wave against this type of argument. And this is reflected in such things. I was just reading an American Thinker article from 2008, Hiroshima Hoax, Japan's Willingness to Surrender Before the Bomb. In the mid-1960s, a growing distrust of government and sympathy for the Vietnam protest movement among American intellectuals revitalized the anti-nuclear Ban the Bomb campaign, which few had taken very seriously before, and spurred criticism of the use of atomic weapons to end World War II. Since then, enlightened opinion has been dominated by revisionism fueled by seductive tales of conspiracy in high places. places, unabashed fact-bending, and manipulation of the historical record. So I think we can see here through articles like this and any number that exist online that people attempt to argue against this, what they call revisionist history, and attempt to argue that, no, of course, Japan was not going to surrender, etc., etc. I'm sure you've seen this type of reaction, but I think it's interesting that that at any rate, this type of article is now necessary, because I think more and more people are questioning the necessity of these bombings and the received wisdom that we've all been taught since we were very young. What's your own take on the way that these types of ideas that you're writing about in this column have changed, have filtered down to the general consciousness? Have you seen any change in the last few decades? How is your writing even on this subject being taken? What kind of feedback have you received?
Well, it's almost every day I'm on the street, people come up to me, recognize my photo as the author of the article, of the column, and they express their appreciation. So I'm getting, of course, I go to, I'm a Green Party member. I go to the Whole Foods co-op. The contacts in the public are sort of a selected leftist viewpoints, I guess. But there are occasional positive letters to the editor, and I get emails, et cetera. So I think I'm making some impact, but perhaps I don't see the evidence of impacting the politics of our region. Even though Duluth is quite progressive politically, it often usually has centrist or maybe left-center leanings in its local politics. I'm not sure that I guess I don't, like a teacher never knows what impact he has on his students. I may never know, but I guess I have faith that truth-telling will have positive impacts. And I haven't had much of a backlash. There's a few military types in around Duluth that object to my revealing unwelcome truths about their deeply held beliefs, say, about Nagasaki and Hiroshima. So they oftentimes will get objections about that. People just prefer not being confronted with an alternative truth, that disproves their deeply held beliefs. That's cognitive dissonance. They feel uncomfortable. They don't know how to handle it. So they sometimes just vacate, or they are in denial, or they attack the messenger or something so that they don't have to change their mind. It's a humiliation to admit that I was wrong. Men especially don't do that, especially men in high power and positions of power.
And to be fair to the people suffering from that cognitive dissonance, especially on this issue, I mean, I think we can all understand how veterans might feel personally threatened or implicated by people coming along and saying something of this sort. But I think it is important to understand that the critique here is not aimed at the average American serviceman, who, of course, was just, a cog in this big wheel. I mean, it's clearly aimed at the people who are planning this from the top.
Mm-hmm. I think it's just the system, the corporate reality is that you have this message, you keep promoting it and propagandizing it, and then you gradually impact the belief system of the underlings who don't have maybe the power or the inclination or the ability, or they're too distracted to really investigate it themselves. So they say, well, I guess if, George Bush says something's true, it must be true, or Barack Obama, for that matter, if he says it's true, it must be true, or the big general chief of staff's guy says it's true, it must be true. A lot of people still have a tendency to believe people who are in positions of authority and let it go at that. And I think it's our culture. We're so distracted with so many things, and we've been indoctrinated by religion or politics or whatever. And so we would prefer not having to think too hard, when I watch a ball game instead of read a book, for instance. So there's a lot of victimization going on by propaganda masters, the masters of war, that American militarism is great. And I titled my article, The Hiroshima Myth and the Glorification of American Militarism. So there's that connection, you know, as long as we believe the myths of the, what the military tell us, then we think, well, that's really great. We need these drones. We need this enhancement of our prowess. We need military bases all around the world because we're the good guys. You know, we bombed Hiroshima. That was a good thing, you know. So we're, the mythology just has its impact on what we think politically or religiously even. One of my, I was a founding member of an organization called Every Church a Peace Church, and that predicated its idea on the fact that the early church of Jesus was a pacifist. He was nonviolent. He exemplified nonviolence that Gandhi and Martin Luther King and a lot of peacemakers modeled themselves after. And so the early church was a nonviolent peacemaker. And so why shouldn't Christianity, the Christian church, also follow the Sermon on the Mount, the love your enemies thing, the practicality of nonviolence? So we are... Our effort with this Leverage Church Peace Church group, which is hibernating now, it's not very active, should be that we should transform the churches into peace churches, real peace churches. And if that had been the case over the last 2,000 years, which it hadn't, you know, the church has been, except for Quakers and Mennonites and a few minor sects like that, the church has been okay with war, and sometimes promoting war and not resisting war like it has. And so the article I'm going to write this coming week is about Nagasaki, which was really a wonderful tale. I think I already sent you a copy of an article I wrote about the untold story of Nagasaki. Turns out that the bomb in Nagasaki, the epicenter was the Urikami Cathedral, St. Mary's Catholic Cathedral. It was the biggest Catholic Church in all of the Orient. It had been founded in Nagasaki, you know, by 500 years ago. Lived a catacomb existence for a couple hundred years, and then after before World War One, Catholics in Nagasaki built this huge cathedral, which you could see from 31,000 feet, which was so it was an aiming point of the boxcar that dropped the Nagasaki bomb. There weren't very many things you could see to identify Nagasaki, except one of them was the Urikami Cathedral. It's massive. So one of the aiming points that the bombardiers saw through the clouds in Nagasaki was the Urikami Cathedral. And all the crew members of that boxcar were Christian. And Imperial Japan had tried to destroy Christianity for centuries. It was an illegal religion. You could be crucified, and they did, if you professed Christianity and didn't denounce it. And so for centuries, Imperial Japan had tried to eliminate Christianity, and yet it had survived and actually thrived and emerged mainly in Nagasaki. That was the center of Japanese Christianity, was Nagasaki, and the cathedral was the center of Nagasaki Christianity. And in 9 seconds, we destroyed that cathedral, we destroyed the center of Christianity in Nagasaki, and it was American Christian bomb crew that did it. So in 9 seconds, American Christians destroyed Nagasaki Christianity when Imperial Japan, Shinto and Buddhist Japan, could not eliminate Christianity. You see the irony.
Hmm. Well, thus answering the question, who would Jesus bomb, I guess?
Good question. Yeah. Nobody ever wants to answer that question.
Yeah, exactly. Or who would Jesus nuke, I suppose, in this case. Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it is just such a startling history. And I'm very much looking forward to the publication of that that article as well. And of course, people can stay tuned to the Duluth Reader for that. I guess I should amend or clarify my last remark, because it might have sounded like I was actually absolving the people who actually did drop these bombs from their culpability in that crime. I don't think that they are absolved from that, but I guess my point would be that to the extent that the people who actually did that are responsible, how much more responsible are the people who prepared and ordered that to happen?
Absolutely. So, yeah. And you know that conflict there, when you're in the military, you swear obedience. Well, I think you're supposed to swear obedience to the Constitution and defend it against all enemies, domestic and foreign. But you are trained to obey your superiors. You obey orders in a war zone. If you disobey an order, even if it's an illegal order, you could be shot, summarily shot, for disobeying an order in times of war. So that's one of the military's rules. So what does the soldier do but obey orders? And then you feel guilty later. And that's sort of the core of post-traumatic stress disorder, combat-induced post-traumatic stress disorder. You're in the war zone, you kill or be killed, and actually you're going to kill rather than be killed yourself, so you may kill civilians or little children or whatever, and the military justifies you doing that. And then when you get out, you have those horrific images embedded in your brain. You can't get rid of them. They create nightmares and daymares and flashbacks and all sorts of things that make you think that you're mentally ill, and you get labeled mentally ill when you have flashbacks. You're told you're schizophrenic rather than you're having a PTSD flashback, which is normal. Any human can do that. And then now you're in the mental health grasp of the mental health industry, and now you're on drugs, and now your brain is starting to be impacted and destroyed and disabled. And so then I wind up seeing the patient with so-called mental illness when actually it's a totally preventable consequence of being in a war zone.
To that stress, I mean, on top of that, of course, the Nuremberg precedent established that, in fact, following orders is no excuse. So not only are you potentially going to be summarily executed for failing to commit orders, well, if you do have a conscience and do refuse, then you could also, if you don't, then you're subject to the war crimes prosecution. So again, so much of this pressure, I mean, obviously, down on the average grunt who does bear a lot of that responsibility, while the planner's at the
bind,
top.
Double bind, you're damned if you do it, you're damned if you don't. What do? You know, you just throw away your gun, you're going to be a deserter. You know, the Bergdahl, the guy
absolutely
couldn't stand it anymore. He walked away. Now he's in trouble for that, you know, so...
All right. Well, Dr. Coles, I mean, just a fascinating conversation. There's a lot to think and talk about on this in this regard. Before we close this conversation, are there any other sources or anything else on this topic that you'd like to recommend to people who are interested in it?
Well, reading the history, I mean, Gar Alperovitz, G-A-R, first name, Alperovitz, has a couple of books that are really good on that. I don't have my library books here with me, but I think if you went online, you can find all sorts of wonderful things. There's a book I have, Nagasaki, The Necessary Bomb, Behind Japan's Surrender, Atomic Diplomacy, The Decision to Drop the Bomb. There's all sorts of good books that people could read. I think the Rockwell site, lewrockwell.com, has a lot of really good historian articles and editorials about that. So that would be good. And I bet your site, you probably have some information on your site that people would benefit from reading too.
Well, there are some in the archives. In fact, I did actually get to interview one of the survivors of the Hiroshima bombing back at the beginning of the Corbett Report. So probably a lot of people, even people who have followed the Corbett Report for some time, probably haven't seen that. So I'll put a link to that also in this, so people who haven't seen it can see it for the first time, perhaps. All right, excellent. Well, thank you again for your time. And Dr. Coles, I think we'll probably have to have you on to talk in the future about psychiatric drugs and how they affect people and the type of work that you used to do as well. And that's a fascinating subject in and of itself. So once again, thank you very much for your time, and best of luck to all of your work in the future.
I enjoyed it. Thanks for calling me, James. Bye.